You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And we just heard how the Netflix series High on the Hog brought the stories of Black people who have shaped U.S. food culture past and present to a mainstream audience. And it turns out there's a lot of appetite right now in recognizing and celebrating Black foodways and culinary traditions. That's something our next guest knows very well. Chef, activist, and educator Bryant Terry is the author of the new book, Black Food, and editor-in-chief of Four Color Books. Featuring the work of more than 100 contributors, Black Food explores Black foodways across the U.S. and around the world through recipes, poetry, essays, art, and more. Chef Terry is best known for his vegan and vegetarian spin on African-American cuisine, so I asked him what we really mean when we say Black food today.
I guess I should start by talking about what I've been pushing back against the past two decades that I've been working around health, food, and farming issues. And it's this very reductive way that people often imagine or talk about or write about Black food. And when people hear that term, I think they think of one of two things. I often hear people refer to the kind of antebellum survival foods upon which many enslaved Africans had to rely. But one, we know that before 1865, they were free Blacks, so we weren't all enslaved. And the institution of slavery wasn't a monolith, and where there might have been, you know, more paternalistic ways of enslaved Africans being kind of fed. That's, let's say, the Black Belt, you know, in parts of the coastal Carolinas or the Caribbean or the, you know, Louisiana. The institution could look different depending on the disposition of the plantation owner, their financial status. So there are a number of factors that might influence the way that enslaved Africans or Black folks in general were cooking and eating. So to simply call it slave food, which I hear many people referring to our cuisine, I don't want to eat, that's just slave food. And you know, vilifying it, I think is wrongheaded and historically inaccurate. But the other thing that people think about when they hear Black food is soul food. And when people hear soul food or say that, what they are most often imagining are the big flavored meats, the overcooked vegetables, and the sugary desserts that one might find at a soul food restaurant. And I'm not denying that either of those things. There are subsets of a larger and richer, diverse and complex African-American cuisine or culinary traditions. And what I want people to do is understand that diversity and complexity and move beyond the stereotypes. And, you know, if you just think about just looking at African-American cuisine, you know, the traditional staples of our cuisine, like you're talking about nutrient-rich mustards and collards and turnips and kale and, you know, things like tubers like sweet potatoes and sugar snap peas and pole beans and black-eyed peas. Like, these are the foundations of what I think many people would say should be a healthful and nutrient-dense diet. So I want people to have a more diverse and complex understanding of what our food is. And you can't talk about African-American cuisine without looking at the diaspora and understanding that, you know, the foods that traveled from West and Central Africa to the New World and melding with the indigenous foods and flavor profiles and ingredients of this country or this land, and, you know, the influence of European cuisine. So I like to think of you know, African-American cuisine is the original modern global fusion cuisine.
I need to pause for a second. I'm so disrupted. Are you saying that, like, white kids in Brooklyn didn't discover kale?
Yeah, and they didn't. You know, the funny thing when you say that, it's not just kale, but it's interesting to me that even something like, you know, chitlins or chitterlings, depending on how you want to describe it, like the way in which Black folks would often be made fun of because of eating animal innards. And now you go to some fancy hipster restaurant and you pay like $30 for some chitterlings or whatever they might call them. So, yeah, you know, I think it just kind of in line with the anti-Blackness that I see just that kind of permeates the society, where it's like people just feel like they need to denigrate our traditions and our culture. And I'm here to say that we need to be uplifting it. You know, I think when we talk about criteria for healthful eating, we often focus on nutrients and micronutrients. And one thing that I think is often missing from that conversation are, you know, cultural foods. And I think that, you know, one of the keys to Black liberation is us embracing our cultural foods, consuming them, cooking them, and, you know, building community around those foods.
So what are other frameworks we can have as Black folks for building community around food?
when you ask that question, the first thing I think about is the activism that I've been involved in for the past two decades around building a more healthful and just and sustainable food system, and understanding that, you know, when we think about, you know, issues with many historically more marginalized communities, many of them being working class and working poor Black communities, being devoid of healthy, fresh, affordable, and culturally appropriate food. You know, so often what I've seen is this idea that you need some kind of outsiders to come in and help fix this problem, you know, whether it's philanthropic organizations or, I don't know, well-meaning white folks who don't come from the community. And, you know, I'm not saying that folks can't be supportive and help efforts in communities to ensure that everyone has access to the human right of fresh, healthy, and affordable and culturally appropriate food. But, you know, I always think about the reality that the people who are living in the most impacted communities are the experts. They know the problems that they face. They often have very inventive solutions to addressing those problems and overcoming those barriers, whether it's physical, economic, geographic, but people need power and resources shifted into those communities. And so I've always been invested in helping build power in communities. And I found that one of the most powerful ways to start those conversations and help people feel more invested in doing that work is starting with the food, you know, not starting with the heady intellectual ideas or the public policy, but actually building community around table, giving people opportunities to care for each other and break bread, and then, you know, using that as a site for strategizing. I mean, look, you know, some of the most powerful organizing that was done during the American Civil Rights Movement was done in kitchens and restaurants and homes around table. You know, so many of the aunties and grandmothers and mothers were feeding these revolutionaries. And so I see the table as a powerful site for, like, literally feeding ourselves, but, you know, feeding the revolution as well.
I have a couple of sort of more, let's call it more grounded questions about some of this. So the first is a couple of years back, I really threw myself into this and really started farming my backyard with everything from, you know, a fairly intensive size, you know, flock of poultry and with, you know, all of my many, many, many raised beds across the acres, which have gotten a little out of control. But here's one of the things I experienced. Man, growing your own food is hard. It is hard. It's hard. It really is actually hard. And I just mean the amount of work, time, energy, love. And sometimes I am so tired from farming, I don't cook. Talk to me about what it means. How do we think about the ways that we engage with food in these multiple levels? I love having my hands in the dirt, but I hate being too tired to make my own food at the end of the day.
Not to say that this is happening for you, but I think that capitalism often convinces us that we need to address problems on our own. We need to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and we need to just fix this problem. And I think that, you know, we can look at multiple areas, but when it comes to feeding ourselves, growing food, building thriving local food systems, these are things that I think is important for us to be engaging in these practices with community. Let's just talk about cooking itself. We could talk about the, you know, your farming and urban homesteading, but, you know, a lot of people will cite the time intensity or the labor intensity or the cost of, you know, making meals from scratch and feeding oneself good food and not, you know, going out and buying processed and packaged foods. And so people feel like it's a lot, you know, with our busy lives and, you know, many people are working more than one job because the job that they were working isn't paying a living wage. And so, you know, I paint a picture for people and I say, imagine this, what if rather than you doing that all alone, what if, you know, people in your neighborhood or family members or whatever community you're part of decide to collectively do it. And everyone gets up early on a Saturday morning, you go to that local farmer's market in town and, you know, you posse up and even before going to shop, how about you do some menu planning and decide what ingredients we're going to be purchasing? And then after we get the food, we go back to the person who has the nice chef's kitchen and lots of room for us all to be cooking and preparing. And, you know, somebody makes a soup, another person makes a casserole, somebody makes a big vat of tea. You know, you can have a week's worth of delicious, freshly made, local, seasonal, sustainable, yummy food that you can freeze some of it and you can put some away. And guess what? You're building community. You're connecting with people that you love. You're supporting the people who are growing our food with integrity and care for the earth and care for communities. So I think the short answer is that we need to build community. And while we're building a better food system for ourselves and our family, we should be building community and lifting each other up in the process.
I love that response. Now, one more question. Talk to me about cookbooks and where they fit in our contemporary moment of how we cook and download quick recipes. I still do love and have some pretty sticky page cookbooks from years and years of returning to them. But how do we think about, or how should we be thinking about cookbooks within this community building of food?
Well, first of all, unfortunately, our industrialized food system and our capitalist society creates conditions where oftentimes people don't have the time and the space to practice cooking. And so even over the pandemic, you know, it's interesting, cookbooks did extremely well. You know, my book, Vegetable Kingdom, came out the beginning of 2020. And then the pandemic hit, my tour was canceled. And I was like, oh, it's done. That book is going to disappear. But, you know, people were invested in practicing more home cooking. And I think that cookbooks are important because it provides a lot of the fundamental skills that I think many of us are lacking. You know, a couple of generations ago, when we were spending lots of time, you know, I learned early on many of the kind of cooking techniques and preserving and canning and pickling from my grandmother. And so I recognize that, you know, oftentimes that's just not something that people are able to tap into. And so I, as an educator, as a community organizer, as someone who's invested in raising people's food IQ, see my cookbooks as a way of empowering people to have the fundamentals of cooking. I mean, look, I may run myself out of business by saying this, but I actually think that, you know, cookbooks should be used as a guide. I think the magic of cooking is spontaneity, creativity, you know, and the kind of spirit of jazz, like working within a structure, but improvising and using that Swiss chard that you have at home, even though the recipe calls for collard greens, or, you know, if you don't do dairy and the recipe calls for milk, make you some cashew cream and substitute it for that, or use coconut milk. So I think books can be useful, but I don't want people to rely on books, because I think that the soul, the spirit, the excitement of cooking comes from just being in the flow.
Just because we're coming up on the holiday or holidays, what's a go-to fall dish that is going to be on your holiday community table this year?
My oldest daughter, Mila, has become I was going to say militant, but I'm not going to say that. She's become a dedicated vegan over the past year. It's been really beautiful because I was very clear. I didn't want to force her to adopt a particular dietary model, because I've seen that go terribly wrong and people, you know, kids kind of rebelling. And I just modeled, and it's been really beautiful seeing her embrace, you know, vegan eating and a lifestyle, because she's clear that it's not just for the health reasons, but she can cite the environmental, the economic reasons. This girl's 10 years old. And so she inspires me, but lots of our eating in our home has been driven by what she wants to do. So we, you know, can encourage her to continue to grow and learn as a chef. And her favorite book these days, I have to just shout out this book. It's called The Korean Vegan. And we have been pretty much cooking out of that book since we got it. And she said that we will be having Korean holiday meals, because that's what she wants to cook.
I love it. I love it. And is she's your oldest, you said?
She's our oldest, yes.
All right. And she's 10. That means she still likes you. And is so when she starts eating barbecue ribs, just like in front of you at 14, just know that it's going to be all right. She's going to come back round. I'm just, as the mom of a 19-year-old and the auntie of some 30 and 20 somethings, I'm just saying there comes a moment when they rebel, but then they come right on back.
Ooh, I needed that reassurance. Thank you.
Chef, I so appreciate you and this conversation. Chef Bryant Terry, thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. It was an honor.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from. whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.